Divining national economic motivations can be tricky, but when it's the second biggest economy in the world, look, you got to give it a shot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 31st of July. Good as always to have you here, everybody. This being the end of July, that means August 1st is tomorrow, which I mentioned because, first of all, it's always good to have an eye on the calendar, right? But also because there is another round of White House tariffs on Chinese imported goods that could kick in as soon as tonight, which puts a report from Bloomberg this morning in a whole new light. The Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's people are having conversations with his Chinese counterparts' people to maybe possibly kind of sort of back slowly away from the trade war. Why the Trump administration might come to the table is pretty easy to figure out. They're already talking to the Europeans. They're getting lots of blowback from farmers in red states and many, many others. Why China might want a deal is a whole other question that we are going to put to Marketplace's Scott Tong. He's done a lot of our globalization reporting and, oh, by the way, used to be our bureau chief in Shanghai. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So, look, I just laid out a whole bunch of reasons why the United States would be interested in getting these negotiations going again. Why is China interested in a deal, maybe?
Well, the Chinese didn't ask for this trade war, right? And by various economic estimates, it would hurt the Chinese more than the U.S. economy. And if you kind of think back about the broader Chinese story, the economic recipe for a long time has been to keep their doors open to foreign investment, foreign ideas, foreign technology. So that's at risk in a trade war. And a trade war gets in the way of this broader narrative that the Chinese are trying to spin around the world, right? They're going around saying that they're the mature grown-ups on trade and globalization in the world. And instead, they get into this spitting match over tariffs. So, Kai, the optics aren't so good.
Yeah, and that was the speech that Xi Jinping gave in Davos like 2-3 years ago, right? We are ready for globalization, and here we are, right?
That's been the consistent message, win-win. Whether in reality, that's how the Chinese behave is another question, but certainly they're sending that message.
Okay, so what, as the Chinese look at their own economy, are they seeing? Where are they strong? Where do they have strengths? And where are they vulnerable, I guess?
Well, if you step back, the super fast teenage growth years for China are clearly over. That was a decade ago. You know, China had just joined the World Trade Organization, became the factory to the world. And normal was 10, 11% growth back then. Right. Now the normal is 6 or 7%, right? So that's a relative headwind, right? They're just slowing down in general. That big fast stage is over. And there's more happening right now, right? The Chinese central bank is tightening credit in the country to limit risky loans. So that's a break on the economy. Stocks are down. The currency is weak. And then, of course, we have these tariffs on top of that. And Beijing seems to be feeling this, right? They just relaxed credit to try to reduce the economy this month. And the Politburo today just came out and said, you know, we have to refocus on growth because the, quote, external environment is different, i.e. the trade war.
So there's a political part of this, which is that both Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, like to talk tough and they like to bluster, as it were. I want to take it past that, though, and get your sense of if there were to be a deal, what would it look like?
Well, for Xi Jinping, he would gain a lot if these trade tensions were eased, right? There are domestic problems in China now. There's this bogus vaccine problem, you know, and they have politics too. So if the Chinese came to the table, you know, what might they bring? Well, they've seen what the Europeans brought, right? They came with their checkbook to the United States and said, we're going to buy more fossil fuels from the United States. We're going to buy some more soybeans. So there's a template, right, for how to reach some kind of a truce with the Trump administration. And the Chinese could also come and say, you know, we're going to open up our markets a little bit because that's what the U.S. is, the whole world actually has been really complaining about, is access to the Chinese market. The challenge, though, is he has to be genuine. Because in the business community, as one businessman put it, you know, there's promise fatigue when it comes to China. The Chinese really have to come to the table with something.
That's a good line. Marketplace's Scott Tong, once upon a time, our Shanghai bureau chief. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thanks.
Not a whole lot of the people that we have been talking to hold out hope that there is going to be a deal between the Chinese and Americans on the steel and aluminum tariffs specifically. We have been checking in every now and then with Sam Desai in South Plainfield, New Jersey. His company makes parts for appliances, and he's got a dozen applications in for exclusions on imported steel products that he needs. He's been hitting refresh on regulations.gov to see whether he's in luck on those exemption requests. He is not.
What a surprise, right?
The Department of Commerce has denied 3 of his applications. 10 more are still up in the air, and he is not optimistic, in part because of how big steel companies are objecting to his exemption requests. Last time we heard from him, he said he actually knows the guy, that's what Sam said, who was filing objections. Now, looks like it's just bureaucracy.
I guess there's a team of people at every company that's commenting on these.
We have called 7 of the steel companies that have objected to Sam's petitions. All of them declined to comment to us. The frustration level is pretty high on this. Kate Carroll's a counsel at a law firm in Detroit with a lot of clients in the auto industry, all of whom are still waiting to hear about their exemptions.
What we're seeing is the kinds of comments that they're filing are the kinds of things like, oh, no, we make that product or we have that product available without any kind of specificity. And so in many cases, it's just not true.
All right, steel and aluminum to something softer yet equally economically relevant. Procter & Gamble today announced it's planning to raise prices on a lot of its products, Bounty paper towels, Puffs tissues among them, because P&G is having to pay a lot more for wood pulp, whence one gets paper towels and tissues. Pulp itself is made from wood chips or recycled paper, and that is in high demand right now, as Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
As always, it's a supply and demand thing. On the demand side, global economies are growing, and so are their appetites for paper goods, especially China's.
China is the largest consumer of global chemical market pulp, and they actually drive the market.
Arno Franco is with the Pulp and Paper Products Council. He says China recently banned imports of a lot of recycled paper. Many worry this will worsen the pulp shortage, but Franco says when it comes to paper towels and diapers, they're most often made from virgin wood pulp. Even so,
simply the idea that there's going to be a shortage certainly gives strength to the idea that you can charge more.
Pulp prices are up as much as 60%. On the supply side, a major mill in South America had to shut down a lot of its production recently. It'll take a while for more pulping mills to come online. David Fortin is with RISI, an industry research group.
We don't see much in terms of supply in the next year or two that will materially move the needle and add some much-needed supply to the market.
All of this means a pricier commodity. Chip Dillon is with Vertical Research Partners. He says pulp is a major part of what goes into a sheet of Bounty.
If pulp is 30-40% of the cost and it's up, 40-50%, certainly you need to see a price increase or you're going to get really hurt.
Kimberly Clark, maker of Kleenex, has already increased prices. Procter & Gamble says prices for Pampers will rise 4%. Charmin toilet paper will go up 5%. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol PG did pretty well today, up almost 1% on news of those higher prices to consumers elsewhere in equity-based capitalism. About the same, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We did a real estate story yesterday, and I took the easy way out in setting it up. I trotted out that old location thing. But we're going to do another real estate story right now, except the setup goes like this. Location, housing development, traffic gridlock. That's a reality in a lot of cities in this country, nowhere more so than here in Southern California, where the cash and non-cash costs of owning an ever-shrinking slice of the suburban paradise, well, they're going up. As part of a statewide journalism collaboration on the California Dream, KPCC's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
On a recent Sunday morning, Jenny Gov showed me around her favorite neighborhood haunts in the L.A. suburb of Lakewood. Places like the local Target.
It's literally like 5 minutes from home.
It was a pretty short tour because Jenny doesn't usually stray too far.
God, I try not to. I try to drive as little as possible.
It's a big change from her early life, growing up in Los Angeles, going out to explore hip coffee shops or seek out a meal in one of the many ethnic enclaves of the city. Now, her world has gotten a lot smaller. She's taken to meal prepping to avoid unnecessary trips to the grocery store. She does workout videos instead of going to the gym. And she's finally giving up the family dentist she's had for more than 30 years.
I think I'm going to just find a dentist closer to me now, just because it's not that far, but because I drive so much, I don't want to drive anymore.
Jenny, like an increasing number of Californians, is an extreme commuter, meaning she spends more than 90 minutes a day getting to and from her job.
I spend 4 hours a day in the car, so that's about 20 hours of driving. It's literally like a part-time job.
She works in communications at a nonprofit about 30 miles away in Santa Monica, where owning a home is way outside her price range. So she and her boyfriend bought in Lakewood, where houses cost about a third of what they do near her job. Lakewood's rows of modest little ranch-style houses and strip malls appear unremarkable today, but a half a century ago, this was the embodiment of the good life in California.
They called it Lakewood, tomorrow's city today.
The promise of Lakewood was enough of an everyday life, enough of the good things of that everyday life. A simple house, a yard.
Historian D.J. Waldie knows that life well. His book Holy Land chronicles his life in Lakewood from the 1950s when the subdivision exploded out of lima bean fields into a suburb of 70,000.
Mass production of modern houses with liberal financing arrangements enabled many thousands of young Americans to own their own homes for the first time.
The mostly working class buyers commuted to nearby aerospace plants and shipyards. Their paychecks afforded them not only a home, but with the new state-of-the-art freeways, a world of things to do.
California made it possible to really reach out to and touch an awful lot of the natural beauty and cultural richness of the region.
But those freeways are now clogged with more people like Jenny Gove who have to drive until they hit a suburb where they can afford to buy. In L.A. County, the number of commuters who spent more than 90 minutes a day on the road grew by almost 30% between 2005 and 2016. At the same time, housing prices have soared to double the national average.
It is a cruel reality of the current economic conditions that some of the ways in which an ordinary working-class suburb like Lakewood made life better aren't available.
So how to solve the dilemma?
We need to build housing.
Brian Taylor is a professor of urban planning at UCLA. He says new housing has lagged in parts of the state where jobs have multiplied.
If you try to add housing in built-up areas, they say traffic impacts. It's going to make traffic worse.
Building denser housing, closer to jobs, means sacrificing that single-family home part of the mid-century dream. And many folks, like Jenny Gove, aren't ready to let that go.
I give up a lot of my life to traffic. But even with that, I think it's just owning a home, a little bit more peace for me.
To many, Lakewood was paradise.
In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This phrase came up in our morning news meeting today, courtesy of our Washington Bureau Chief Betsy Streisand. We were talking about how some companies are, and here's Betsy's quote, looking to recapture their elite market. Case in point, Ralph Lauren. The company reported profits this morning and did quite nicely, thank you, courtesy of a rebranding effort that has them selling fewer items for more money. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris reports that's a strategy that's worked for luxury brands for years, a slide into discount territory, and then a recovery as a high-end purveyor.
If you shell out thousands for a handbag, you don't want to see a Maxinista toting the same bag that she bought for way less. When it comes to luxury fashion, exclusivity is key.
If everybody has access to a product or a brand, it doesn't really make it that desirable anymore.
That's Jeff Gallick, marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon University. That's what makes the luxury sector unique, says Sucharita Kadali, retail analyst with Forrester Research.
And having your products be more coveted is often something that can drive higher earnings.
But staying exclusive, not so easy for mid-level luxury brands like Ralph Lauren. In the wake of the recession, not enough people wanted to buy their luxury stuff, but they kept making it. So those companies dumped more and more of it into discount stores. And consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow says that led to oversaturation. And
they lost a really valuable brand image.
And along with it, they're higher-end shoppers, key to their financial success. But these days, some brands are pulling back from discounting and only selling at top dollar.
It's difficult to do a rebranding, but it's not impossible.
That's Jenny Vrilou, who runs the Yale Center for Customer Insights. She says the real challenge is changing shoppers' beliefs.
Getting back that mystique and desirability that they once had for the brand.
Fashion houses make decisions when they have too much. They can sell items at a discount or do what Burberry and other exclusive brands do, literally burn their excess inventory. Bottom line, for brands, the middle is a hard place to be. People either want to spend a lot or a little. So brands are picking a strategy, either going up or down the market. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
As the cost of housing and transportation and medical care and all of that have just continued to go up.
Poverty and its generational cycle straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 108 today. That is 0.4%. Ended at 25,415. The NASDAQ up 41 points, about 0.5%. 76.71. The S&P 500 gained 13 points, 0.5% there as well, 28.16. Heavy equipment maker Deere dug up 4.7% today. Its profits would be hurt by China imposing tariffs, more tariffs, one should say, on American soybeans. Engine maker Cummins gained 4% on better-than-expected quarterly profits today. The construction equipment maker Caterpillar rose 2.9%. Genetic testing tools maker Illumina brightened 12.1% today. It raised its forecast after a strong second quarter. Tesla had a good day, that ahead of quarterly earnings after the bell today, up 2.75%. Polo, Ralph Lauren, ticker symbol actually is P-O-L-O. Not so good, down 0.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's economic shorthand is brought to you by the letters E, C, and I. Taken in that order, they stand for the Employment Cost Index, a report from the Labor Department, the latest of which came out this morning, that showed employers in this economy have apparently started stepping up their game. Thanks to low unemployment and the attendant strong labor market, workers are getting better pay and better benefits. The ECI in June, the Labor Department says, went up 2.8% over a year ago, the fastest pace in nearly a decade, which is great. But Marketplace's Rima Kreis hit the streets of downtown Los Angeles to see what people are actually experiencing.
Eva Medina has worked at the same law firm as a paralegal for 18 years. I run into her outside of Starbucks, coffee in hand, and ask her whether she's gotten a pay raise recently. She sighs.
I sigh.
She usually gets a 2% raise each year.
Unless you cry, and then...
Have you done that before?
Oh, yeah. I had to cry last year.
Cost of living just keeps going up, she says. So you cried. How much more did they give you?
They doubled it.
So 4%.
I got actually 5.
And in terms of benefits, most people I talked with say not much has changed.
No, not really.
No, not really.
In terms of benefits, no. But benefits have stayed the same.
The lucky ones, if you can call them that, well, their companies have given them other things, like professional development opportunities. Coleman Richardson, who's in marketing, says his nonprofit is letting him go to 2 conferences this year.
It does seem like there's a bit more investment in employee potential.
In you?
Yeah.
Christina Ruelas works at a company that manages charter schools. At her last job,
they introduced pet insurance as a benefit, which is like I hadn't heard of before, and now it's pretty commonplace to have life insurance as a benefit or long-term disability as a benefit.
She says companies are offering extra perks because the labor market, it's strong, and it's hard to find qualified workers who don't already have a job.
I think that the shift has been more towards retaining quality employees versus just attracting any walking person that's in coming in.
And as long as that's the case, workers may see more raises and hopefully do a little less crying. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
According to the most recent report from the Census Bureau, the official keeper of these kinds of statistics, there are just over 40 million people in this economy, adults and kids, living in poverty. That's almost 13% of the entire population. And while it's the federal social safety net that gets a whole lot of the attention, states are right there on the leading edge of dealing with this problem, how to get more kids out of poverty specifically. Research not too long ago from the Annie E. Casey Foundation showed Utah is making the most progress in reducing childhood poverty. And one way they're doing that in particular, as Marketplace's Renata Sago reports, has been to work on intergenerational poverty within families.
Emma, baby. Emma, come here. Hi, baby.
Stephanie Snowball picks up her 3-year-old daughter and 7-year-old son from daycare in Salt Lake City at around 5:30 most days, right after dinner time. It's convenient because their kids get a good meal and she gets to save on expenses. The 34-year-old single mom's only income is from the state for food and childcare, and her housing.
If I didn't have my grandparents, I would definitely be like in a shelter or something right now.
Snowball is one of 99,000 Utah residents the state considers living in intergenerational poverty. She's had her share of obstacles. She grew up in a rural town with parents she said did what they could for her and her siblings, but they got divorced when she was 9.
Then my dad turned to drugs. My mom was an alcoholic. We kind of raised ourselves and just kind of kept going with the struggle.
Snowball's been through evictions and health issues. Her latest obstacle, divorce from a substance abuser. She's hoping to break the cycle of struggle for her 2 youngest kids' sake. And an initiative meant to remove obstacles that keep families poor may help her do that. It's called Invest in You Too. The 13-week program gives single mothers on state assistance, job training, and life skills coaching. In this session at Salt Lake Community College, Snowball and her classmates hear from a licensed clinician about how to schedule their lives around a job.
You might want to start thinking about, oh, what time will I have to be to work, Mom? How early is it that you have to get up?
Utah lawmakers passed legislation in 2012 requiring that Utah focus on reducing its poverty rate. The Invest in You Too program is one result. It targets single mothers, often trying to overcome more than just poverty.
We have some people that were on drugs and now they're 2 years sober and now they're in our program.
Danielle White is a family success coach for Invest in You Too. She's helped teach program participants a range of skills, like how to budget, set goals, and write a resume. The women are all working toward a certificate in medical device manufacturing, a booming industry in Utah. White says they have a shot at jobs thanks to the program's relationships with companies.
Our referral with a lot of those companies does hold a lot of weight because it shows that we've kind of like vetted them a little bit and they are ready for work.
Invest in You Too is funded through grants from the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. That money's helped nearly 36 women secure jobs in the past year and a half. Liz Carver is with the Utah Department of Workforce Services.
Sometimes we think that we can get away with just giving a little bit, but if you truly want to innovate and see change, you have to invest in that.
Pam Perlick is an economic demographer for the University of Utah. She says programs like Invest in You Too are critical because escaping poverty is getting harder.
As the cost of housing and transportation and medical care and all of that have just continued to go up, we know that's the case for many households in across the country.
The state of Utah plans to continue Invest in You Too and start a program that helps fathers. In the meantime, Stephanie Snowball is preparing to graduate from the program and is hoping to land a job making at least $13.25 an hour.
Somebody that my kids can look up to.
Her ultimate goal is to get her own place, pay her own bills, be independent. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which comes with this caveat. Apple gets, IMHO, entirely too much coverage for things that are entirely not newsworthy enough. That said, here's a tidbit following the company's third quarter earnings report that came out today after the bell. Went quite well, too. Thank you very much. The company has, at its last public disclosure, an and I'm rounding here, 4.915 billion shares outstanding. Where I'm going with this is that ticker symbol APPL needs to hit just north of $203 a share, $203.45 to be exact, to become the world's first publicly traded company with a $1 trillion market capitalization, closed at $190.21 today, headed above $196 after hours. All right, we got to go. The Dow was up 108 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 41, about 0.5%. S&P 500 also 0.5%. That is 13 points on that index. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.